Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures into everyday terms for regular folks. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson. I'm joined by my partner, co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams-Byers. And today, we give you an update on the only remaining active criminal case pending against President-elect Donald Trump. It's the hush money case in New York. As of now, the 34 felony convictions... Let's start over. I misread. So
it's okay. Can I just briefly give you something to laugh at? Because I'm sitting here crossing my fingers. I came home. I couldn't join at 10 o'clock because I was out running errands. I come home. My husband's outside doing the yard. And I noticed that there's a waft of bacon in the house when I walk in. And I noticed there's a plate in the microwave. And I'm sitting here like, please, God, let that have been my plate of food, because I just ate up all my husband's food while sitting here talking to y'all. So okay. I'm hoping my marriage is not going to be impacted by the fact that
there you go. Then he comes in and there's no bacon. No, all right, let's start again. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures and brings them down to everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my partner and co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams-Byers. Today, we give you an update on the only remaining active criminal case pending against President-elect Donald Trump. It's the hush money case in New York. As of now, the 34 felony guilty verdicts still stand. But the question is, will they survive an onslaught of motions from Trump's criminal defense attorneys as inauguration approaches? Judge Gail, we've had a lot going on. Let's just quickly, let me summarize the two federal cases by Special Prosecutor Jack Smith, the one in Washington about the election interference, dismissed. The one in Florida, confidential documents, classified documents, dismissed. The one in Georgia, tied up in the Court of Appeals, is going nowhere. I heard the term that it's been mothballed. So the only case going on is the case where Trump was convicted, or not convicted, he was found guilty of 34 felonies. And since that time, he has not been sentenced. And since that time, his defense team has filed a slew of motions trying to get the case thrown out. The most recent that was decided just this week was a motion for a new trial. And summarizing that, it really was a motion to dismiss the case based on presidential immunity. And if our listeners remember, back in on July 1, the U.S. Supreme Court came out with a really extensive ruling on presidential immunity, giving the president absolute immunity for certain presidential acts, presumed immunity, presumptive immunity for other presidential acts, and then a real question about non-presidential acts of whether there should be immunity regarding those and how much testimony would be allowed in cases involving unofficial acts. All of that quagmire came to rest here in Judge Juan Merchan's court, where Trump's attorneys filed a motion, as I said, for a new trial or a motion to dismiss based on the immunity clause. Judge Merchan denied that motion this week, Judge Gale, and really did it, I think, in a spectacular way.
Well, I think what we saw from Judge Marchand is consistent with what we've seen all along, right? There's been, I think, concern at the pace at which he's responded to some of these concerns. But at the end of the day, he's managed to really very methodically walk through and work through all of the very unique issues of these cases, such that each of his opinions and his decisions, which are written opinions, so it's not as if he's merely taking the bench and he's making oral pronouncements and we're relying merely on recordings, but he memorializes them in very well thought out, well reasoned written opinions. They are always worth the wait, I will say. I have not been disappointed by and maybe just because, you know, we're nerds, right? But I've not been disappointed by a Judge Marchand written opinion yet. And it's not that he always rules with the rationale that we expect. I mean, I was actually taken aback when he actually invited the defense to file their motions to dismiss in the case, especially after now President-elect Trump had won the last presidential contest. So that was interesting. But notwithstanding that, it gave him, I think, a magnificent opportunity to take all of the evidence and information that had been presented at trial and to synthesize it in a way that we can all understand and appreciate. It's masterfully written. And I'll say, you know, he does not need a copy of Strunk and White's The Elements of Style. Now, I know some folks who do. And they could certainly benefit from just some basic
English
lessons
grammar.
in prose, but that is not Judge Marchand. But what's more is, you know, he's so thoughtful in how he does this. He's so thoughtful in how he lays it out. But moreover, if you never take his opinions and you read them, right? If you only read the headlines and you only are watching the news, and so you get the gist of it. One thing I can say that I believe has been a great benefit to the judiciary as a whole, and maybe those who may not agree with him right now, they may not be so willing to embrace this. But I think what he's done is he has certainly helped to reinfuse faith in the justice system, where even as us as retired judges have lost a bit of faith in the system, given what we've seen. But I think he's done that because I cannot imagine. Can you imagine where we would be as a society if we pluck 12 random people off the streets, we ask them to disrupt their lives, we tell them to sit through weeks and weeks of testimony and also, you know, lots of chicanery and you know, craziness and an awful lot of theatrics. And we ask them to perform this high civic duty, jury duty. They do that and deliver a verdict only to have that tossed aside, not on the merits, per se, but because the defendant just happens to be who he is and happens to have been engaged in, you know, a political process at the time. What does that say for the entire process of jurisprudence and what we ask people to do, normal citizens to do when we require? We don't ask them, we don't send them RSVPs, we send them subpoenas. And we tell them that you have to show up. And only under extreme circumstances do we excuse their being there. And when they do that, the idea that this all could be threatened and undone and taken away, again, not for meritorious reasons, but just because the defendant has launched a political campaign, I think it would speak so poorly of us as a country and as a nation. And I think there are those who are already concerned about that. But I think by extension, even though this wasn't Judge Marchand's intent, I'm confident, and I don't know the man, but I'm confident he did not write this opinion with this in mind, I just think that is a huge ancillary benefit that society really did need right now.
His opinion, if we can get into it a little bit, was very interesting, and I think we can use it as some points of education about the legal system.
Oh, yeah, and he went to basic points. It wasn't even like it was deeply, you know, deep legal theatrics. It was very basic points.
The defense argued that the presidential immunity decision in United States versus Trump should throw out the case. A couple of ways that you know, it was presidential duties, therefore there was absolute immunity. Then they got into some evidentiary questions that we'll get into in a moment. But the initial decision of Judge Merchan was that the conduct that was on trial, the 34 guilty verdicts, was personal conduct and not presidential conduct. Therefore, United States versus Trump, the immunity case crafted by Chief Justice Roberts, does not apply.
Indeed.
And
he was
and
very
just
clear
that,
to say that
simple statement, I think, is so powerful.
And in fact, it is. It really does, again, kind of go to the heart of all of this. It strikes at the heart of the defense motion, which is, you know, hey, all of this, or at least a good part of this evidence, should have been excluded because the immunity decision protects this behavior. And they even, and rightfully so, as the defense, an aggressive defense should do, they pointed to the testimony of certain witnesses, such as Hope Hicks, in identifying that, you know, this was, or alleging that this behavior was covered by this immunity decision. And Judge Merchan just really meticulously, almost like Legos, right? Like a Lego scheme that had been constructed.
Yeah,
he meticulously took it apart and deconstructed it so that he explained and showed to the defense that, you know, these things are not considered, you know, presidential acts. These are all personal. And insofar as the opinion from the Supreme Court in the immunity case can and should be respected, whether you agree with it or not, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter whether you respect it or not, because it doesn't apply to these circumstances. And the reason is because, again, all of the acts that were identified here are personal, because this was about covering what happened. Was he meticulously outlined that this behavior was taking place when he was a candidate, had not yet been elected, and therefore you can only have one president at a time. He was not the president when he was first negotiating, when the act took place, nor when he was working hard to ensure that the disclosure of the information was not revealed. These were things that were done, again, in his capacity as a candidate, not as the president of the United States, and therefore they are personal. I'll note, and I know that we're going to get to this as well, which is that second piece, which, you know, we commonly refer to as the raise or waive trigger in any trial, which is the fact that as the trial itself was going on, the defense attorneys were aware that this immunity case was meandering its way through the Supreme Court.
Let's hold on that for just a second. So he made the decision based on immunity. That's one thing. That could be argued to a court of appeals, whether or not he was correct on that. However, his additional rulings made it more difficult, I think, makes it more difficult for an appellate court to reverse him. And one of the issues brought up by Trump's defense team was that the United States versus Trump, the immunity decision, prohibited certain evidence from being admitted. And in this case, it would be primarily the testimony of Hope Hicks and a couple of others. Mm-hmm. And it was not objected to at the time of the trial. Now, let's break that down. That is not based on immunity. That's based on standards of trial practice that are ingrained in New York State law, that if you don't object to something at the time of trial, you
that's
waive
what it means to
or
raise it.
Give up the objection.
And that's what it means to waive. So for our audience's benefit, Judge, what you're describing here, and correct me if I'm wrong, is when you say if you do not bring up a particular objection to something, whether it's evidence, testimony, exhibits, or anything, that's called raising it. Bringing it up means to raise it, correct, to bring it to the court's attention, to make it known in the record that you have objected to it. And a failure to raise it or bring it up results in you not having or not preserving the right to argue about that later, which is called a waiver or waiving it. It's like saying goodbye, waving it away. And so
giving it up.
Giving it up is like waiving. So if you can think of it as raise and waive, raising an objection or waiving an objection, either you let the court know that you are objecting to this. And what the court can do is, if perhaps the same thing is happening, it's repeating over and over again, you can ask the court to note what's called a continuing objection so that you don't have to raise it every time it comes up, but rather you put the court on notice that this is the blanket concern. And if the court does not rule the way that you would prefer or that you desire or that you hope, and if it is, you know, of course, supported by law, you can ask the court to note your continuing objection to its use throughout the life of the trial. Failure to do that, not doing that, means you give that right up. And if you find out that, as in this instance, there was ultimately a decision by the United States Supreme Court on the issue of immunity, you can't then come back and say, well, I know we didn't say anything then, but yes, look at the record. It's replete with instances when this would have been applicable or when this would have applied. And so now we want the court to know that we now we take issue with all the times the court allowed this evidence or this information to come in. And so we are now objecting, and to wit, the court would say, you gave that up because you never said anything when it was actually happening. And no one has the ability to foretell the future, but you did know that this case was pending in the Supreme Court.
And the defense argued that we didn't know that the Supreme Court was going to decide this way. I mean, my God, we didn't know it.
The height of disingenuousness, right?
We couldn't object, although they knew exactly what was being argued to the Supreme Court and what the potential of a Supreme Court opinion would be. And Judge Marchand basically said, hey, if you wanted to object, you should have objected. Mm-hmm. If you don't, you give it up and you can't complain. It's like, you know, arguing that the rules should be changed after the game is played.
Indeed. When the flag on the play has already been determined and you're like, but wait a minute, we'd like a redo on that. This is like asking for a mulligan in a court case, which could have very deleterious effects. It could really, if this happened in every court case, first of all, Judge, I don't know that we'd ever see resolution in any case ever the trial stage.
We wouldn't. You know, because the law is always in flux. It's always changing.
Yes.
And if you want to preserve an objection, if you think that you have a reasonable right to object to something, state it. And if you don't, you give it up.
Indeed. And I don't think there's anyone, no matter what side of the coin you fall on with regard to this prosecution period, But I don't know that there's anyone who can genuinely, who would genuinely say that the defense team had no idea of what the arguments were before the U.S. Supreme Court in the immunity case. Again, that seems to just smack of not being genuine. And I think Judge Marchand did a really good job of kind of laying out that, you know, yeah, I think it's very reasonable to say you all knew that this case was before the United States Supreme Court. You knew what you were essentially asking the court to do, and whether the court went even beyond what you asked them to do in rendering the immunity decision, the fact is that you were aware, and you were aware enough that if in fact this was a concern, then these should have been objections that were raised at the time of trial in real time when it was happening, not because now you are ecstatic because you received this favorable opinion from the U.S. Supreme Court, and you'd like to use it to completely undo everything.
So Judge Marchand made part of his decision by saying that you didn't raise the objection, therefore you waived it, you gave it up. And then he went on to say that if there was any mistake in admitting evidence, it was harmless. Because in light of all of the evidence, it was overwhelming evidence of guilt.
Given the weight of it.
Given the weight of it. And so therefore, if there was an error, it was harmless error. Now, this is a term that comes up in law a lot, especially in appellate work, and that's the term harmless error. Can we break that down for people so that they understand what that means?
Oh, absolutely. So first, I'd like to start with the idea that every case, every trial case is going to have there's going to be baggage. There are going to be challenges. There's going to be flaws.
Trial, right?
Indeed, they are absolutely. It's going to happen. There's no such thing as the perfect trial. It just isn't. I tried to have one, but I never did. Right, and especially in the eyes of the person who's not happy with the outcome, no such thing as a perfect trial. However, for the errors that do take place within a trial, there are degrees of error. And in this instance, when we're talking about harmless error, this is when either the trial court and often the appellate court finds or determines that whatever errors were committed by the judge, and generally these are errors that are assigned to the judge, that they are not significant enough to warrant a new trial or to have the outcome or the judgment reversed. And so what Judge Marchand was saying in this instance is that even if he agreed with the defense that permitting certain witnesses or certain evidence to be admitted and certain witnesses to testify, that the overwhelming admissible evidence, stuff that would not have been subject to challenge by the defense, that evidence is so overwhelming and is so compelling that anything else that was admitted is so minuscule, so tiny, so technical or tiny in effect that it would never have affected the outcome of the trial. So assume arguendo that Hope Hicks never testified. If the state never called Hope Hicks as a witness, the court decided that the other evidence that was presented was so voluminous, it was so compelling, it was so much of it that the outcome would not have changed. It still would have been the same outcomes. And sometimes these errors are corrected during trial. What the defense is arguing is that the errors were not corrected during trial and that they were so egregious, they were so terrible that they themselves impacted the outcome of the trial. And so Judge Marchand's point was to make sure he pointed out that this is not the result of a single person testifying. This is not the result of a single piece of evidence being admitted. And nor was that testimony or that evidence so damning or overwhelming that that was the linchpin, but it was at best cumulative. It added to what was already there, but what was already there was so much that even if you didn't have it, the outcome would have been the same. And that's what makes the error harmless.
So for our sports junkies out there listening to us, if you follow basketball, there's an old phrase, no harm, no foul. And that means, you know, in basketball, you're not supposed to touch anybody, right? But there's always touching. There's bumping, there's colliding, there's a little nudge here, there's a little shove there. And most of the time, the referees let it go. Unless it impacts the play, it impacts the a score, then they may call a foul. So no harm, no foul. That's sort of what harmless error is, you know? Mm-hmm. No harm, no foul. No, you know, it's harmless. We're not going to do anything about it.
Correct. And that's exactly what Judge Mershon found was that, you know, if he were considered the referee, he would have said, no harm, no foul here.
So let's talk a little bit about, you know, a court of appeals looking at Judge Mershon's decision on this motion, because for sure it will be appealed to the higher courts in New York and maybe try to get it up to the Supreme Court. You know, the waiving of the objections because they didn't raise them, the harmless error. Don't appellate courts, it's been my experience, that they defer to a trial judge who was there at the trial to make those decisions of what is harmless and what is not. They can't look at a paper transcript necessarily and consider something harmless. It's a really hard standard to win at the appellate level. Would you agree with me?
I absolutely would. And I'm going to answer that in a couple different ways. First, I think it's important for us also to define or identify the other form of error that the defense is alleging actually took place in the trial that is not harmless error. Pardon me. And this is called reversible error. What the defense is pointing to or suggesting with this motion is that the permitting of the evidence, the information, the presentations, anything that the court permitted that was considered a presidential act in direct contravention of the immunity decision would and should be considered what we call reversible error. Now, again, there are two forms of error that an appeals court, or in this instance, the trial court itself, is considering when balancing this motion to dismiss. And we've already discussed with what harmless error is. So you can kind of consider reversible error as being kind of the opposite of harmless error, because what it suggests is that, again, in these trials where there are no, you know, perfect trials, there are no error-free trials, but sometimes errors do occur. And some errors are considerable and they really do have an impact. And what the defense is arguing is that the errors as committed by Judge Mershon in this case were so of the nature, and they were so egregious that the mistakes made or the errors made actually impacts or had an impact on the outcome of the case. And it is the duty of the party that's appealing or complaining, in this instance, is the defense, that has to demonstrate that the mistake or the error that's committed by the court was so substantial. And it was substantial enough that It is that error that actually, had it not happened, the outcome of the case would have been different. And so they have to show the impact of the court's decisions that actually affected the outcome and demonstrate how that could have and did, in fact, affect the outcome. By Judge Mershon saying, listen, you know, I'm not going to suggest that this was a perfect trial. As you said, Judge Hodson, you know, we've been in search of the perfect trial, haven't found one yet.
Never done one.
And so there's broad agreement that, yes, there are going to be mistakes in every trial. But what he said at the very onset was, I don't disagree that there may have been errors in this trial. And as to those that you point out, defense, that you are considering or calling errors on my part, I don't disagree that they were errors. First of all, I believe, and in my analysis, I believe that what you've pointed out is everything that has no application to this Trump immunity decision. But even if I were to agree with you and to say that those were errors that were committed, what I would say is that the error is so harmless that it would not have changed the outcome. Meanwhile, you have the defense that's saying, no, that's not harmless error. That's reversible error, because had you not done that, then the outcome would have been different. To wit, as we've said here today, the judge clearly does not agree with that. And you're right, Judge, that if there is an appeal to the appellate court in New York, and understand New York system is a little bit different, because in New York, their trial court is one of the few trial courts that's actually referred to as a Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And every other
strange state, terminology.
It is very strange terminology. So as we tell you often that you have to really defer to the laws in your state, wherever you are listening from. And if it's not a state, if it's your country, then we welcome our international listeners. But that's why it's important to not be so tethered to certain terminology. Because again, in the state of New York, the trial court, which would probably be called a district court or a trial court or a common pleas court or superior court anywhere else, is actually called the Supreme Court in New York. When you appeal to the higher court, that is the appeals court. And so in this instance, what is being asked is that the appeals court look at the Supreme Court's decision, Judge Mershon's decision, and instead substitute their judgment for his by merely reading the record. Just like you said, Judge Hodson, and appeals courts are very reluctant to do that because they don't have the benefit of the same impressions that the trial court did. They cannot determine facial features, tone of voice, actual responses, whether it's physical or otherwise. They defer to the wisdom of the judge, because the judge, having the firsthand knowledge, firsthand experience of this case, which is relied upon in reaching these decisions. Now, there are many instances when appeals go to appellate courts, and notwithstanding the benefit of all of that, they still make determinations that cause reversals, either in whole or in part, of decisions. But when it comes to harmless error like this, I think you're absolutely correct in that it makes it far more difficult for an appeals court to come in and to substitute, if you will, because that's what the defense wants the court to do. They want the appeals court to substitute their judgment for Judge Mershon's judgment, even though Judge Mershon had the firsthand experience of this trial, which I think is a really heavy lift. And it's really, really difficult. And I would be absolutely surprised. Quite frankly, I would be shocked if an appeals court anywhere thought that they had a better vantage point than the trial court judge in this instance.
Okay, let me bring it back to my sports analogies for a moment and see if I'm right on this. We talked about reversible error compared to harmless error. And I was talking about basketball bumping, little elbowing, little nudge, harmless error, didn't impact the play. However, let's take a situation where somebody is dribbling, hell-bent for leather, towards the basket to make a layup, and drives over a defender, knocking the defender flat to the floor. a clear what's called a charging foul. Makes the basket, but wouldn't have made the basket but for knocking over the defendant on the way to the basket. That's reversible error. The foul is called and the basket is taken off the scoreboard. So that's a difference between harmless error and reversible error. Now, to what the Judge Gale was just talking about, where courts of appeals have to look at the record and determine whether it was harmless error and defers to the trial court, let's switch sports. Let's go to NFL football. You know, if there is a call by an official, a referee on the field, and that call is challenged, an appeal, it goes to the video booth, right? And the video booth has to have conclusive evidence to overturn the instant judgment of the official on the field. So to overturn a trial judge's decision that something is harmless error, there would have to be conclusive evidence that it wasn't. Does that work?
You are absolutely correct.
So let's hope some of our sports fans out there can follow the law. I've always said that they're often similar in competition, but let's hope that they can follow along. So
well, this can be complicated.
We're trying. Our whole purpose here is to make things understandable for folks. So we're trying. There are three more motions or three more things out there on this case, Judge, that have not been decided that I think we should talk about. One is it seems like a convoluted motion that was filed on December 2nd by the defense and basically says all this stuff has to be dismissed. The whole case has to be dismissed. The jury verdicts need to be thrown out. Everything needs to be dismissed because Trump won the election. He is now president-elect. And all of this is interfering with his official duties, which is inappropriate under the law. So dismiss it, wipe it clean, take an eraser, erase it from the page. What do you think?
That it is a far-fetched argument. It is absolutely untethered from reality. And here's the thing is, would you have, I don't know, maybe we could have or would have expected the same argument had he not won the election. But I think that the defense feels like it's bolstered because he in fact did. But I also think at the same time that elections, and this actually goes back to something I think Judge Chutkan said, is that courts don't care about elections, nor should they, when there are matters of criminality that are before them. They are completely detached from that. It does not matter that the defendant was a presidential candidate at the time, has since won the election, and is now, you know, preparing to be what, quite frankly, is new space in this democracy. Do you realize that for the first time in our American history, we will inaugurate an individual who has been found guilty by a jury of their peers, who has faced
34 felonies.
Yes, has faced multiple felony indictments. And by the way, for our listeners, because I've had to do this for others who are offline and they still kind of lament the outcome of the federal cases, you may recall, and I'll encourage you to review our prior episodes where we talked about what dismissals are and dismissals with prejudice versus dismissals without prejudice. And that the other, the federal cases have in fact been dismissed. But remember, the keys are still available. The door is not welded shut. The file is still in the room and it can still be accessed at a later date. Right now, the same kind of, you know, question swirls around as to what Judge Mershon will do when it comes to finality for this New York case. Will he hold on to the keys for 4 years? Will he impose a sentence? And will the imposition of that sentence mean, you know, result in, you know, what is, you know, essentially little or nothing? Whereas if he were John Q. Public, maybe he would face incarceration. We don't know yet because there's still another motion to dismiss pending.
We'll get to that in a moment.
And indeed, we'll talk about that. But I think there's something to be said for the fact that you have a defense that has heavily leaned into the immunity decision from the United States Supreme Court, is kind of using it as the catch-all, save-all to completely erase everything that we have experienced as a country and watching this unfold. And again, I would even go as far as to say the federal cases are not erased. They are essentially on hold because there's no dismissal without prejudice, which means they can be refiled, absolutely can be refiled unless they are dismissed and that door is welded shut. It just means they're not going forward on them right now. So it does not mean that someone escapes all responsibility because they either declare their the candidacy for presidency and then ultimately wins. That is not the case here. And we also are reminded that particularly in New York, that there are some clear issues of sovereignty between states and the federal government, and that whereas the federal government may elect or choose not to proceed with certain prosecutions, that does not impact the decision of states. Look at New York. We don't know what's going to happen in Georgia, but I can tell you New York has not been the least bit affected or impacted by the decisions that the federal government has made about their own cases. And we can, I think, expect that there's going to be full resolution in this matter. And that resolution, I don't know what that looks like, except that the next step would be sentencing if, in fact, the Judge Mershon does not grant the last pending motion to dismiss.
Okay,
it may be sentencing.
Let me jump in here. And on this motion that was filed on December 2nd to dismiss because it interferes with Trump's official duties, Judge Mershon may render a decision any day. It may be before this episode is published. So keep an eye out for that. If it hasn't been decided, we will talk about it at a later time. But if Judge Gale has called me the master of minimalism, so let me try
far
this.
Better than I.
Let me try this one more time. I think Judge Mershon, this is an easy motion for him to decide. When someone is elected president, between the time that they're elected and January 20th, they have no official duties. You are a president-elect, but we only in this country have one president at a time. President Joseph Biden is the president until January 20th. So interfering with official duties when you have no official duties, even though you're trying to impose your will on Congress and the executive branch and everybody in media, those aren't official duties. That's your imposition of duties, your follow through on campaign promises. Those are not official duties. So I think this will be dismissed. That motion will be overruled. I do not know when, but that's one that is pending. The second one
I chime in real quick, Judge?
Sure.
Just to think that, and if you think about this in a more practical sense, think about the fact that in the capacity as president-elect, all you can do is announce what you intend to do, such as who you intend to nominate for certain cabinet positions. You have no authority to actually do that. Now, you could actually maybe influence how people may ultimately potentially vote, but you have no authority to do anything. You cannot sign executive orders. You cannot command the military. You cannot place heads of state or ambassadors or even heads of departments. You can talk about all the things you're going to do, but you are absolutely right, Judge. We recognize one president at a time. And insofar as there is a president that is currently seated, that in the person of President Joe Biden, that means President-elect Trump is just who he is, President-elect Trump. In fact, we don't know. There's never a guarantee that, you know, someone will actually make it to inauguration, right? There are any number of things that could happen. And I'm not suggesting that that will, or right. I'm not wishing that either. I'm saying that life happens and that in the event that something takes place between now and January 20th, then my goodness, that means the country now still has to deal with whatever the constitutional crisis that may evoke.
All right. This next motion. It's not even a motion. This one just boggles my mind. The defense just this week sent a letter to Judge Merchan, copied to the prosecution, obviously, alleging massive juror misconduct during the trial, but didn't want to put it in the form of a motion, because if the defense put it in the form of a motion, the judge would be obligated to have a hearing, a court hearing, on that motion where evidence of juror misconduct would have to be proven through testimony and or documents. The prosecution said, look, you know, Judge, you can't rule juror misconduct on mere allegations in a letter. You know, we have no opportunity to cross-examine. Nobody is under oath. I think this is going to quickly go nowhere, but the audacity of doing this just appalls me.
It's shocking that something like this, and I'm a recovering prosecutor, you're a recovering defense attorney. So I would ask, is this something you would ever consider doing? Because I think as a prosecutor, I would have just had a clutch the pearls moment. Like, I cannot believe this is what we're entertaining now.
No, I would have filed a motion, but they don't want to file a motion. They don't want to have a hearing. They don't want to have Trump there. They don't want to have these people cross-examined. It's just another way of throwing the spaghetti against the wall and see what sticks.
Well, and it's also, I believe, another way of just trying to gum up the process and to try to see, is there any way we can slow it down more? Is there any way we can wreak just a little bit more havoc? Is there anything else we can do to just, because I think the strategy for a lot of this has been, how can we slow this process? You know, why are we speeding to sentencing? I think we should do something to kind of, you know, make sure this doesn't happen so fast. And with that in mind, I think there's been some success.
Now it's reversed, Judge. Now they want to speed everything up and wipe it all clean, you know, between now and January 20th. It was slow walk everything up until Election Day. And then after Election Day, it's now, oh, we got to hurry up and get this over with.
Well, until they start reading the tea leaves, right? Because, and again, I think it's strategic, because consider the idea that, you know, should Judge Merchan decide that the pending motion to dismiss lacks merit and rules against the defense, then the only thing left is sentencing. And I'm willing to bet donuts to dollars there's going to be no rush at all to go to sentencing.
Well, that's the last item. We said there were three. One was the December 2nd motion on interfering with official duties. The second is the letter on jury misconduct. And the third is sentencing. Sentencing was originally scheduled for November 26th. The judge has postponed that indefinitely. He has heard from both parties on that. He really has three choices. He could sentence Trump before January 20th, probably with no jail time and you know, a tap on the wrist, not even a slap, a tap on the wrist. He could wait and sentence him after his term in 2029. In other words, put the case on ice, put it on hold until 2029. Or the third option is to not sentence him at all, ever.
Or to not sentence him until his term is over.
No, not sentence him ever. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the three options: sentence him now, wait till after the term is over, or not sentence him at all.
Yeah.
And just leave it hang. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I will tell you, from the standpoint of a jurist, obviously those are three very viable options. I genuinely believe that the first option of sentence him now would no doubt result in perhaps the most lenient of sentences he could ever imagine, because I cannot imagine sentencing someone who is about to begin their term as president of the United States to a term of incarceration.
But he would go into office as a convicted felon, sentencing having been completed. He would go in as a convicted felon, and you know the defense would appeal that like crazy, probably
indeed.
Right up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Indeed, although I don't know that there would be, you know, what would be the basis of appealing the conviction, even at that standpoint. I think what Judge Marchand has done kind of masterfully is you know, fairly bulletproofed the matter. And yes, although it would go to the Supreme Court, would have to meander, I would think, through the New York appellate process first. And so
yeah,
he'd still have that label. Yeah,
he'd
still have that label for at least that duration. So that's number one. Number two, though, when I think about what a sentence could be, it could be a sentence with maybe a state term of incarceration. So the court could, in fact, impose a fine and a term of incarceration not to be served until after the presidency has concluded. I think one of the biggest things that the average person in society, again, no matter what side of the political spectrum you fall on, I think one thing that most people should be concerned about is the big question of, if it were you, would you receive this type of deference and leniency if you were?
I would have been in prison months ago.
And here's what I will tell you. If you think you would have been in prison months ago, no doubt I would have just never gotten out. I don't know that I would have made bond.
Right.
And so I would not have been out the entire time. So there is something to be said for not just the fairness in the process, because it is not just the defendant who is owed a fair trial. It is the state who represents the people, the rest of society, who is also owed a fair trial and a fair process and even a fair outcome. And if it had been any other random person, John Q. Public, who's facing something similar, you ask yourself, would this be the deference that that person would have received? Is it the deference I would have received were it me? And if that answer is no, then again, I don't care what side of the political spectrum you fall on, because politics aside, this is just about
going through a judicial process, a fair determination, not by the judge, but by a jury of your peers as to culpability, and the return of guilty verdicts on all counts, save none, every single count, and the idea that there may be an escape hatch available for some people, but not all people, just doesn't settle well in a society where we're expecting everybody to play by the rules and also enforcing those rules against everyone. That is really troubling. And so, yes, Judge Marchand can impose a hefty fine. And again, any fine that's imposed is not going to have any real deep financial impact on the defendant, Mr. Trump. Why? Because he's flush with cash. The whole point sometimes of imposing fines is to deter behavior. But if you are flush with cash and you also have someone who's a good buddy of yours who's willing to bankroll any and everything you do, then the money's not an issue. It's not an object, nor is it ever going to be a deterrent. So imposing a fine, which is within the court's realm, the court could do that. A fine, I don't believe, is going to really respond to the behavior. Would a term of incarceration do that? Well, we already know that actively serving a term of incarceration, at least right now, is impossible. That's not going to happen. That's not likely. But could the court suspend that to a date certain in the future? Sure. And get the case resolved. So if the judge says, hey, listen, in addition to a, multi-$1,000 fine, I'm also going to impose a term of 10 years incarceration to be served beginning this date. We see it in federal courts all the time, right? When they have a date to surrender, you'll give them a date to come back after the holidays or settle up your affairs and come back. Well, he can have 4 years to settle up his affairs and then serve his time. That's entirely possible. The court could also just wait and tap its foot for 4 years and then announce the sentence and then require that at that time, 4 years down the road, that the sentence be served immediately. Why? Because he would no longer be in office. And
I think that's what Judge Marchand's going to do. He's going to take his foot and there will not be a new sentencing date. It will be indefinite, which will be after January 20th, 2029.
Yes, I can't imagine him never. I can't imagine him getting to the third option that you outlined, which is to never, ever, ever sentence him ever, which is an option.
That would be the ultimate. But that, letting things hang.
But I think that would also be the ultimate betrayal to the public,
is to
let it hang. And for anyone who ever gets another subpoena to show up for jury duty, to perform this civic duty, you're going to have a hard time really stressing upon folks the importance of their participation in this process when you can have something like that happen. But I think whatever it is that Judge Marchand does, I think as he's done before, that he'll be really clear about articulating that. He'll telegraph that, meaning he'll set a new sentencing date. He will tell us really clearly that he is, not going to sentence him now, but he'll, sentencing has been set for sometime in 2029 or whenever, which should, I would hope, satisfy the public. But I'm also a huge skeptic, right? So if he's tapping his foot for 4 years, he better watch his back for 4 years too, because I think there are some folks that are completely unhinged. And if they believe that their way to vindicate this is by doing something nefarious, I don't put it past them.
Let me just, we have about a minute or two left and that's all. But Trump called the order illegal, psychotic, called Marchand corrupt, incompetent, a radical partisan, and that the opinion that he rendered this week was knowingly unlawful. Hmm. Now, that kind of rhetoric goes to your point of, we're now threatening the judiciary.
Yep. We are. But he's also giving license to others to do that as well. So it's not just Judge Marchand that becomes a target. It's all judges, even retired judges. I'll tell you, I don't do this often. Those comments on that he's made about Judge Marchand's alleged illegal, incompetent, wrong decision, This is from someone who does not have any legal training. He has a robust legal squad around him that he doesn't listen to, but he's got no training of his own. And so you do have to take it with a grain of salt and say, okay, so we're talking about the rantings of a non-lawyer who's just angry because he's the subject of these decisions, but he also can command and control the minds of millions. And that's really scary. And that means other people, and some of these other people who've done similar things are equally high ranking, but they're, you know, these are folks that are sometimes running your cities, your towns, your hamlets, your communities, your counties, or whatever, they're equally unhinged. And they will say equally unhinged things about the judiciary. And they have no basis for their rantings either. And they feel completely vindicated, invested in doing this, because you have somebody who's now ascending to the highest office in the world who treats the judiciary like this. So they see no need to moderate their language or their behavior either, because they are just as ill-informed and they are just as, you know, untrained in the law, and they feel just as powerful to say or do whatever they think is the right thing at that time. And that makes for a bad environment for all judges, again, whether sitting or former. It makes for a bad environment. And it also begs the question of, if that's the case, who's going to want to do this job in the next generation? Who's going to do it?
Judge, we're out of time, and we got to tell people how they can find us.
You can find us on every major platform where you find your favorite podcasts. We want to start by giving a big shout out to NPR, National Public Radio, for being a huge supporter and sponsor through WOUB. But you can also find us on Spotify, on Apple, on Amazon. Again, anywhere you find your favorite podcast, merely type in Next Witness Please in the search bar. You'll see us right there. And we are so honored to be able to bring you what we hope is informative information that improves your life when managing the various machinations of the law.
Boy, machinations. That's a big word to end on. If you have a question or comment about our podcast, you can email it to me at hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, at ohio.edu. Also, WOUB Public Media is the one who produces our podcast. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back soon to give you more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.